Decision time for Greece.
And the global financial system hangs in the balance.
From APM, American Public Media in New York, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
And I'm David Brancaccio. You're listening to the Marketplace Midday Update. It's Friday, June 15th.
Coming up, a solution to Europe with a harmonious ring to it.
Popcorn takes center stage in Washington.
And Coca-Cola goes after one of its last remaining untapped markets.
Those stories and more coming up on the Marketplace Midday Update.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
We'll start with the mood in Greece ahead of this weekend's crucial elections.
I think whichever way, in and out of the euro, things will go the way they are about to go, which is actually they will become worse for the next probably 3 to 5 years.
I'm very angry against our politicians and against Europe in general, because I think that we didn't deserve this situation.
That was 55-year-old Anna Maria Hagiafrati and 32-year-old Christos Karanatsis speaking with the BBC.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard joins us now to lay out the possible scenarios for this weekend's elections and what they might mean for the rest of us. Stephen, good morning.
Hello, Jeremy.
Well, tell us what might happen this weekend.
Well, there are two likely scenarios, one good, one bad, from the perspective of investors. First, the Conservative New Democracy Party could win most seats and form the next government. And that would be a government that would broadly stick to the terms of the bailout of Greece. That would mean the bailout money would continue to flow and Greece would carry on in the eurozone. That, as far as the markets are concerned, would be a good outcome.
And what's the bad outcome then?
Well, from investors' point of view, it would be if the left-wing group Syriza forms the next government. They could reject the bailout terms altogether. The cash could be turned off and Greece could crash out of the eurozone with very unpredictable consequences for global markets. If Syriza does win on Sunday, all eyes would then be on Germany to see if the Germans are bluffing or whether they really would cut off the cash to Athens and pull the plug on Greece.
Marketplace's Stephen Beard in London. Thank you.
Okay, Jeremy.
So what will we know and what won't we know after the polls close in Greece on Sunday? The BBC's Mark Lowen is in Athens. Mark, good morning.
Good morning.
For people monitoring the situation, should we be looking for a definitive outcome by Sunday night, even Monday morning?
Well, there will be results that will be coming through on Sunday night. Whether or not it's going to produce a conclusive result is another question altogether, because it could precipitate days of wrangling to try to form some kind of strong coalition government. And if that fails, then really we'd face a third election, which would be exactly what Greece and Europe does not need at this time of immense political instability.
Now, in the case of no clear outright winner, is it possible that maybe a lesser-known, smaller political party could end up being kingmaker?
Could be kingmaker, but we sort of know which one it would be. It would probably be a sort of small left-wing party called the Democratic Left. The big question really is which of the two big parties, the pro-bailout centre-right New Democracy or the anti-bailout leftist Syriza, comes first? Because under Greece's electoral system, the party that comes first gets an extra 50 bonus seats in Parliament.
Mark, I've been getting conflicting reports. Is there or is there not a blackout on polling data this close to the election in Greece?
There is. Under Greek electoral law, no opinion polls are allowed to be published in the last 2 weeks before election day. In the last couple of days, markets have soared. Yesterday, the Athens Stock Exchange closed up 10%. Amid speculation that internal polling is suggesting that the pro-bailout parties are getting some kind of lead. But it is just rumour, it is just speculation. That could evaporate between now and Sunday, and that's why this is pretty much the most unpredictable election in Greece for many decades.
The BBC's Mark Lowen in Athens. Thank you very much.
Pleasure.
For an American take on this now, let's bring in Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. He's with us here in our New York studio. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, Chris, what are your main concerns as we head into this weekend's election or re-election in Greece?
Well, everyone is at least thinking about the Greek end, right?
The Greek end.
We go into this. So main concern, I think, is we come out of the election on Sunday with another hung parliament. There are three parties. They're all polling strong. I don't think they can form a coalition.
And what happens if that happens, if there's no clear winner from the election?
Well, you know, it's interesting. Already, Europe has cut off aid to Greece to the point where they can only afford to make the interest payments on what they owe for aid to Greece. So I think at that point, Europe sort of washes its hands and starts trying to move them peacefully to the exits.
Moving Greece to the exits, what happens next then with countries like Italy and Spain that are sort of on the brink themselves?
Well, that's the point, is that the idea would be to move Greece out easily so that they can bring all their resources to bear to prop up Spain and Italy.
What about the United States in a situation like that? You know, we've been fearing what might happen if there is a Greek exit all along. But what happens to our economy if we get thrown into that kind of uncertainty next week?
Okay. Substantial risk of a small economic impact. We don't export much to Europe, but a small risk of a substantial financial impact. And the key is going to be how they deal with financial institutions in Europe and whether they provide support.
Now, Chris, you know, there is the are we going to regret this? If we look back, obviously, there's a big price of keeping Greece in the euro if it can't pay its debts. But aren't we going to look back at this and say we should have kept them in there?
Yeah. You know, I mean, the word everybody's using is Lehman moment. Is this the Lehman moment for Europe? I think everyone's hoping maybe it's more like the Bear Stearns moment. It's disruptive, but we can move on from it. And that's why everyone in Europe is focusing on propping up financial institutions.
Chris Lowe, chief economist with FTN Financial. Thanks as always.
Thank you.
Now, whatever happens in Greece, one solution to the debt crisis you're likely to hear more about is something called a euro bond. The idea is that euro countries could borrow money together, as Christopher Worth reports.
When a country sells a bond, it's borrowing money to fund things like school teachers and roads. In Europe, when investors lend money to good old reliable Germany, they're not worried about getting repaid. On the other hand, with financial trouble in Spain, Portugal, and Greece, lending money to other Eurozone countries is a much riskier bet. But what if Germany shared that risk and partially backed money lent to other Eurozone countries? Then you'd be saying hello to Eurobonds.
Hello.
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 If the Eurozone were like this barbershop quartet...
We're a harmonious Rex. I'm Hal Cohen. I sing lead.
Which Eurozone country would Cohen be?
Oh, gosh. As lead in the Eurozone, I'm thinking I would have to be Germany.
Then you have the bass, the baritone, the tenor.
Our tenor's a replacement tenor, so maybe he's Greece.
The truth is, without Germany as the lead, all those other players would have trouble booking shows and selling tickets. Translate that to Europe, and that's the position countries like Spain and Italy find themselves in today. Investors are becoming less interested in hearing them sing solo performances.
Every morning, every evening, got Eurobonds.
Of course, they still like to listen to Germany sing.
Not much money, oh, but honey, got Eurobonds.
But when Germany croons alone, Shaheen Vallee of the Brussels-based think tank Bruegel says the tune falls flat.
In fact, Germany has benefited greatly from the euro and therefore benefited greatly from the quartet.
But when the baritone, bass, and the tenor can all gather around Germany's lead, they form a quartet, or a Eurobond, that's backed by the entire Eurozone.
Not much money, oh, but honey, got Eurobonds.
That assures the audience of investors. Troubled Eurozone countries can borrow more cheaply, and you get harmony.
Even if we owe the grocer, got Eurobonds.
I'm Christopher Worth for Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to freakonomicsradio.com.
How do you improve the well-being of people around the world without wrecking the planet in the process? To draw up a blueprint, some 50,000 activists, policymakers, and business executives are gathering in Rio de Janeiro for next week's United Nations Conference on Sustainable Development. To get a better sense of the challenge, look at China. It's an advanced industrialized country, and it's a poor developing country, all at the same time. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz joins us from Shanghai to talk about this. Rob, good morning.
Good morning, David.
So we have this big summit here, drafting a blueprint for what's seen as a sustainable global economy, and renewable energy has to be a big part of that. Last year, China was the world's biggest investor in renewable energy, but of course, a huge polluter. Help us make sense of this paradox.
Yeah, despite or because of the fact that China is the world's biggest polluter, the country scrambled to do something about this. And obviously, you know, China's developing very rapidly, and the road that they've taken has been quick, but it's also been really dirty. You know, China still builds on average one coal-fired power plant a week. And of course, more and more Chinese are buying cars. GM is selling, of course, more cars here in China than in the U.S., as we know. So all of these things are contributing to the increasingly toxic air here. But all that new money means the Chinese government can also spend a lot on renewable energy, too.
So we'll give them high marks for the renewable energy investments. But given the dirty growth, are they actually going to start to shrink their carbon footprint in the years to come?
Well, I talked to UC Berkeley environmental law professor Alex Wong about this. He told me China's carbon emissions are going so fast that it would take a lot more investment in renewable energy to offset those emissions. And he cautions anyone who's quick to blame China for its contribution to the world's carbon emissions.
I think sometimes the debate misses how much of the responsibility is also in the U.S. and the developed countries that are, after all, shipping a lot of industries to China and purchasing the goods that China is producing.
All right, so lots of blame to go all around, Rob. But the summit here is also about figuring out what richer countries can do to help countries in the developing world, like China, pursue sustainable development. What is China looking to get out of the summit in that regard?
Money. And you're thinking, don't they have a lot of money already? Well, when you look at it per capita for their population, not really. They're still a developing country. And they and the rest of the developing world will use this summit, as they've used previous climate summits, to ask the developed world to help them fund more renewable energy and clean tech projects. But obviously, it's not a great time to be asking the U.S. and the EU for money right now.
All right. Marketplace's China Bureau Chief Rob Schmitz from Shanghai. Rob, thank you very much.
Thanks, David.
In Washington, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau has been asking people to send stories in about financial scams, crooked payday lenders, murky mortgage documents, and other shenanigans. It's formulating its first list of shame, as Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports.
In a video on the CFPB's website, Director Richard Cordray puts a high priority on gathering consumer complaints.
Join us. Work with us. Help us make it so. Visit consumerfinance.gov. and tell us your story today.
Compiling a national database of consumer grievances helps the agency know where to focus resources, says veteran consumer advocate Ralph Nader. Plus, he says, the Bureau can use the complaints to respond to political opponents.
It's very effective to say, well, Senator, Representative, send one of your staff over and see all the responses from Americans around the country.
But a former policy director at the Federal Trade Commission, Todd Zawicki, says compiling complaints doesn't necessarily lead to good consumer policy.
You want to measure that against the total number of people who are using these products and that sort of thing before we leap to conclusions just based on anecdotal evidence.
Complaints about credit cards will be released soon by the CFPB. Whether the Bureau reveals gripes about other financial products is still to be determined. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
The Senate has been working on what's called the Farm Bill, a spending plan that is aimed in part at helping the nation's farmers. But as with any big legislation, there is a lot in there. Marketplace's Eve Tro reports on one of the lesser-known subsidies up for debate.
To you, it's the sound of popcorn. But to some, like Senator John McCain, it's the sound of pork. An amendment in the current Farm Bill would keep government protection for popcorn crops. Popcorn is a tiny kernel in the big bowl of U.S. agriculture, but without the subsidy.
What will happen is Farmer Jones will say, well, instead of raising popcorn on this 200-acre field, I'll just raise field corn.
Larry Brewer at Schlesman Seed Company has sold popcorn to farmers for 40 years. He says field corn is just easier. That's the stuff used for corn syrup, corn oil, or animal feed. And field corn is covered by government crop insurance. If popcorn doesn't get that same insurance, there's no reason to risk growing it, says Ohio farmer Rick Fruth.
It's going to make it more difficult for companies to convince farmers to grow popcorn. The consumers will pay.
He says popcorn companies already had trouble signing on farmers this year. No popcorn subsidy could mean paying even more for that buttery tub at the movies. I'm Eve Tro for Marketplace.
The cell phone maker Nokia, which said yesterday it's laying off 10,000 people, has an idea to stay relevant on college campuses. It's going to work this way. The company's giving the entire freshman class at Seton Hall University in New Jersey free smartphones, the Nokia Lumia 900, apparently. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports on whether a gimmick like that will work.
At the fancy grocery store across from my office, I can usually get a whole lunch worth of free food just by grazing.
So this is Bubby's Pure Kosher Dills, and then Rick's picks the People's Pickle. So
customers might well buy a product if they can try it in the store or take home a free sample. But the Nokia Lumia 900 isn't a pickle. It's an expensive smartphone. Retail analyst Patty Edwards says if students like it, the giveaway is golden.
If they don't like it, however, the ripple effect in terms of social media and how fast that will get out is huge.
Analyst Marshall Cohen at the NPD Group says giveaways can work for cheaper products, too.
All you have to do is look at the beauty business. They've been doing gift with purchases for decades. People love to get something for nothing.
But it better work. Otherwise, consumers feel cheated, like the product they got for free wasn't worth anything to begin with. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Coca-Cola is trying to get one step closer to buying the entire world a Coke. This morning, the company announced plans to re-enter Myanmar for the first time in more than 60 years. After decades of isolation and military rule, Myanmar, you may know it as Burma, has recently been opening up to the global economy and, to some extent, democracy.
Here to talk with us about Coke's global presence in our Midday Extra is Roberto Herrera Lim, director of Eurasia Group's Asian Practice. Good morning.
All right. Good morning.
Remind us of the changes that the Myanmar Burmese government had to bring about to be able to get to this stage.
Yeah. They've done a lot of work over the last 3 to 4 years. And basically, this all started like maybe 5 years ago. They were really worried that their economy was going to suffer from being so isolated. They were worried that inflation was rising. In fact, they saw Arab Spring before the Arabs saw it. They were worried that a worsening economy would lead to social unrest. So they started to go in a process of political and economic reform. It started with a change in the constitution, and then elections, and then the freeing of political prisoners. So I think governments throughout the region recognize that this kind of change, being difficult as it was, needs to be given due recognition. And that's why we're seeing the lifting of sanctions or the suspension of sanctions that are taking place across Europe and across the United States as well.
So Coke operates in every country except Burma / Myanmar, as well as Cuba. They're not there. They're not in North Korea. What do you think that Coca-Cola's announcement means symbolically for Burma?
Well, it's obviously one of the best known, if not the best known brand in the world. So for Coke to come in, especially with, you know, the recognition that it's a U.S. public company and therefore careful about reputational risks, careful about how it does business, the signal it sends by saying we're ready, we're willing to invest in Burma, not just come in, but really saying they're going to make significant investments is a rather important signal to the rest of the world. For the Burmese government, it's a big feather. It's a major feather in their cap that they can bring in such a large investor in a short amount of time, because normally a Western investor would say, you know, I'm going to wait a year more to see what happens.
Yeah, it's very quick. I mean, is there a lot of work that has to be done to start selling Coke very quickly like that?
Yeah, there's a lot of work. And I think one of the things that's maybe pushing Coke a little bit faster could be the fact that the Europeans have already lifted or suspended sanctions. So they might be worried that other countries in the region, whether you're talking regional producers of like, you know, Thai beverage producers or Philippine beverage producers, might get a step up ahead of them, because they got blindsided by that in some other countries as well.
Now, it was pointed out in a Wire story this morning that this move by Coca-Cola is going to mean that only Cuba and North Korea are the places that Coke does not do business. It was pointed out this morning that, of course, you can buy a Coke in Cuba. Can you buy a Coke, do you think, already in Myanmar?
I'm pretty sure, you know, it's a country with a weak regulatory system. There's a lot of smuggling. It has borders with China. It has borders with Thailand. I am pretty sure you can buy much of any Western product there, but not in volume and maybe not as deep into the country, definitely at the border areas.
Roberto Herrera Lim, thank you so much for joining us.
Oh, my pleasure.
Now to the many uses of duct tape. For those into arts and crafts, there's the duct tape wallet. As a personal care product, I find duct tape, given a good yank, makes short work of 5 o'clock shadow. But there are limits to duct tape, it turns out, Jeremy. In Montana, the Livingston Enterprise newspaper is reporting a Canadian truck driver the other night tried to use duct tape to stop his fuel tank from leaking,
ooh,
and then he went to sleep. It did not work with the environmental impact, 300-gallon puddle of diesel at the truck stop.
Wow, that's an interesting idea. And finally, David, the NBA Finals are going on between the Miami Heat and the Oklahoma City Thunder. The Weather Channel called this matchup a meteorologist's dream. But the network points out that, in fact, these team names don't make sense for their respective cities. Turns out Miami actually has more thunderstorms every year than Oklahoma City, and Oklahoma City has had more days of 100-plus degree heat than Miami. So there you go.
Weather Channel people pretty literal, aren't they?
I guess so. But I must say, we're here in New York, where I'm pretty sure it's been a while since anybody's seen a real-life Knickerbocker. I'm Jeremy Hobson in New York.
And I'm David Brancaccio. This is the Marketplace Midday Update on APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.